So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Very special episode, made special by the fact that we do not have a guest this week.
That's right. It is so special that we're depending on ourselves here for today.
Well, it's been a couple weeks since we sat down for a conversation, and it's not good for me to go for more than a couple weeks without a conversation.
That's true.
And it struck me a couple days ago, as you and I were contemplating what to do this week, that we got a lot of listeners who probably don't know that much about us. Maybe they know me, right, but they don't know you. Maybe they know you, but they don't know me.
Right.
And it really might be helpful going forward to give our listeners some context of where we're coming from.
Share our street cred as
yeah,
addicts.
Yeah, but you know what? Where has our recovery journey taken us?
Right.
Where has it taken us from? What course has it taken? And why do we ask the questions we ask?
Yeah.
So, how are we going to do this, David? Are we going to interview each other, or are we just going to have a conversation? What do you think?
Well, let's just have a conversation, and if we feel like interviewing each other, or we feel like maybe we're wandering into territory where we're assuming someone might know something about us, we'll ask each other to unpack the background of that a little bit, maybe.
Okay.
But yeah, let's pretend we're at the Frothy Monkey. How was your week?
All right. And our engineer, producer, director guy, Rex, can also intrude at any time.
Absolutely.
To give some direction. Okay.
Third voice.
Well, let's just tell the listeners, you and I knew you as a face and a name.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time before we became friends.
Right.
Because you were the very prominent, at that time, music director, worship leader, minister of music. I don't know what the title was.
I was director of worship and arts ministries was my official title.
But okay.
It was a glorified worship leader.
But I saw you every week, the smiling face there. I saw you directing a whole team of highly skilled musicians and, you know, creating a worship space for people.
Yeah.
And shortly after Allie and I arrived at that church, she discovered part of my addiction, which is sex addiction. She caught me online downloading porn. It didn't take her completely by surprise because I had disclosed to her a couple of times early on in our marriage that pornography had been an issue for me.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that started for me back in adolescence, as it does for most boys. I mean, every boy eventually sees porn.
Right.
You know, every boy instinctively likes porn because it depicts something that we're wired to want.
Right.
For reasons that I didn't understand at the time, but am gaining more clarity on with every passing year, I was set up very, very vulnerable from family situation, early death of my mother, home dynamics, church dynamics, a lot of loneliness, a ton of shame. I was a sitting duck for the powerful medicative effects of pornography. And I was sucked quite quickly into a very secret, private world, a fascination with porn and sex that because of my reputation as a a budding Christian leader, somebody who would go into professional ministry, a superstar, and a really nice guy.
Right.
You know, a squeaky clean Saint Nate who never would have had a dirty thought in his mind. That guy.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I had to hide this growing fascination and this intensifying activity. And that led to a ton of shame, a ton of guilt, which I was certain would end when I got married.
Yeah.
Because I thought that porn was about sex. I thought sex addiction was about, of course, I didn't know it was addiction at the time, but I thought it was all about sex, and I was focused on that activity.
Mm-hmm.
And I was desperate for the day when illicit sexual activity would end, and everything would be beautiful and you know, sanctified and completely fulfilling, as I, you know, as Allie and I made love like rabbits every day for the rest of our lives.
That's yeah. right.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
My goal at like 15, 16 was that I wanted to have sex before Jesus came back. I'll just insert that into your story.
Yeah, absolutely.
How we kind of think sometimes in pre-adolescence, adolescence, and fundamentalism, which is really a fun combination.
But. Yeah. And you and I were both raised in fundamentalist circles. Mine was ratcheted up a little further because we were Pentecostals.
Right.
Yeah. And as wonderful as sex turned out to be, and I did experience sex prior to marriage, but not with my wife. She and I really towed the line. We got very close to the line, but we towed the line and played by the rules. And the honeymoon was didn't quite live up to expectations.
Yeah. We called our honeymoon Amateur Night at the Apollo. But go ahead.
Yeah. So I married an older woman. Allie is 10 years older than I.
Yeah.
And became a stepfather. On the day we got married, I had a 10-year-old son, and I was 22. I guess he was 11. I was 22.
Mm-hmm.
And before long, pornography returned, much to my dismay. It then intensified because this is, by the way, this is in the 70s when porn is most of it's softcore porn, it's Playboy and Penthouse and that kind of stuff. The hardcore stuff is in seedy adult bookstores.
Right.
And I entered one of those with my wife on a seminary-sponsored trip to New York City. Around 1979.
Wow.
And got my first look at the stuff that any six-year-old can find in 2 minutes today on the internet if they're unsupervised, and was immediately just hooked. It's the power of video. Of course, this was pre-video. They were showing 9mm films.
Yeah.
But there's something in the brain about the moving image. And this was even before there was sound in the peep show booths. I remember being startled the first time I heard sound on a peep show.
Wow. Did that take it to another level for you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And then...
And now, you know, we're beginning to understand what this kind of stimulation does to the brain, the intensity of it.
Right.
Which gives us pause... real pause. It gives me real concern to contemplate our prospects now that technology's abilities around virtual reality are improving so dramatically.
Right.
So it's not far off when simulated sexual experience will include, simulated touch, a full 360 experience.
Yeah. And I heard a concept the other day, through a client about something called a sex bot, which I wasn't aware
was
in the making, but, you know.
Oh, sure. Quite lifelike sex robots.
Right.
Already, robot-staffed brothels are opening in some countries.
Mm-hmm.
and people are buying, you know, and when you incorporate artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. the ability to learn and adapt mm-hmm. into these robots, then mm-hmm. you can create your dream person. Mm-hmm. That has far-reaching, terrifying implications mm-hmm. for human sexuality.
Right.
Because it so alters the arousal template that normal human interaction can't really compete.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Because even at its most basic form, porn is an artificial experience.
Oh, sure.
But taking that artificial experience onto these different levels
right.
then takes our brains to different levels of expectation and different levels of, like you said, arousal templates. And then we get in situations of intimacy and conversations about what that even means.
Yeah.
And inability to experience intimacy and because we are so artificially oriented.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. And to me, one of the most pernicious aspects of pornography, modern pornography, especially now that tube sites are available, you no longer have to download porn to view it. You can stream it. Mm-hmm. And there is a virtual endless supply and endless variety of pornography, is that it's conditioning us to novelty. Mm-hmm. So I always have to have a different body, a different face. So it doesn't matter in the end how beautiful, wonderful, how accommodating my spouse is. Mm-hmm. My spouse is only one person. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we've gone far afield. I will tell you this, that during those years, and I went on to fulfill the family destiny for a while. I went to seminary, became a minister, as was expected. Mm-hmm. My reputation was intact. I kept it intact, was never caught. Mm-hmm. I had to really hide and successfully hid my porn use, which progressed, big surprise, mm-hmm. to prostitution. Mm-hmm. It was as though I was following a script. It was as though I was on autopilot.
Right.
The first time I picked up a woman on the street. I did it innocently, trying to give her a ride out of the rain. Didn't know what she was doing till she was in the car and propositioning me. But that experience, mm-hmm. it felt like I'd fallen down a well. Mm-hmm. I knew I was going to do that again. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't live with myself, hated my own hypocrisy, tried desperately to quit. Mm-hmm. And that's the mistake that most of us make in recovery, no matter what our medication is. We focus on quitting. It's the not. It's the stopping.
Mm-hmm.
I stopped 1,000 times.
Yeah.
I just couldn't stay stopped. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand what was going on underneath, and I didn't know how to legitimately and in healthy ways meet the needs that my acting out was trying to meet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right?
Right.
So after 5 years in the ministry, I quit so that I could live with myself and so that I maybe wouldn't make the front page of the paper when they finally caught and arrested me.
Right.
Went into business where I had the misfortune to succeed and make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of money for me anyway, and yeah. far less accountability than I'd had in the ministry. And then I just went off the deep end
yeah.
and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on pornography and prostitutes. Yeah. But it was shortly after we had moved from South Florida, where the worst part of my active addiction went down. Shortly after arriving here and arriving at that church, mm-hmm. because I still was faithful in church, loved church.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a church persona that I desperately tried to get to live outside the building, but mm-hmm. I just never could get him to. Yeah. to when service yeah. was over, so was he, you know?
I believe I understand that.
Yeah, but yeah. I loved the church me. I really did, and everybody else did.
Yeah.
And I made sure that that was the me that other people saw.
Yeah.
But shortly after our arrival here, you know, Allie caught me and caught a glimpse of how desperate the situation had become. And I had been acting like an asshole addict for quite a long time.
Yeah.
She didn't have an explanation for the dismissive way I treated her, my defensiveness, mm-hmm. and all the unaccounted times, my habit of disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
Now it kind of all made sense.
Yeah.
And it was at that point she told me that she was done. She said mm-hmm. those words that I'll never forget. I still love you, but I don't like you. I don't trust you. I don't respect you. And I don't think you can ever change.
Wow.
And that was kind of my intervention. That was mm-hmm. that was the point. She gave me the gift of desperation at that mm-hmm. point. She was my only true friend at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Even though our friendship, which had been strong and close at the beginning, had certainly withered to an alarming degree
mm-hmm.
Because of my secrecy and hiddenness.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to lose that. And yeah. that's what drove me to my first 12-step meeting. And there, by the way, somebody handed me the big book of AA, and a new world opened up for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a few years after that, after getting a lot of help in 12-step world, that the idea came to me. Actually, my wife proposed to me the idea that by this time I was walking with and talking honestly with about a dozen guys.
Mm.
Those guys knew my story. Nobody else did. I had not made any kind of a public disclosure, really, at my wife's request. She mm-hmm. was terrified
mm-hmm.
that we would lose all friends, all respectability. We'd be pariahs
mm-hmm.
if the church or the people in our town knew that Nate Larkin was actually a sex addict in recovery.
Yeah.
So I promised her that I would always speak elliptically and in code and generically about addiction, but I would never name my own.
Mm-hmm.
That may have sparked a bit of a guessing game as to what is Nate Larkin's addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think very many people would have suspected it would have been sex. It just didn't fit with my reputation.
Right, right.
But by this time, you know, a few years in, I'd experienced sexual sobriety. I was walking for the first time in something that resembled some, integration and integrity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My brain was working again.
Mm-hmm.
Creativity had sparked. I was able to connect emotionally with other people in a way I hadn't been able to since childhood.
Mm-hmm.
But I was walking with about a dozen guys, and life was very, 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 very full.
Mm. Yeah.
And Allie, at that point, suggested that as grateful as she was for the changes that she'd seen in me, and by this point she had decided that she could trust me again, she'd made the decision to stay, that she really thought it would be good for me and for my friends if I actually got my friends together.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And let them kind of talk to each other so that I wasn't the hub at the middle of the wheel.
Right.
Right?
Right.
She knows very well my messianic ambitions, and she saw a troubling pattern emerging again.
Yeah.
Where I was becoming the Nate or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's then, with the help of some other people, encouragement of some people, we started a really radically egalitarian fellowship. Specifically, this one specifically aimed toward Christian guys. Because I found, by the way, that a lot of the Christian guys who I talked with had a tough time in 12-step recovery.
Right. Yeah.
The familiar language wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to be able to integrate their spirituality with their recovery, and they were finding it hard to do. And some of them were obnoxious, as I was, by the way,
mm-hmm.
in early recovery. I thought I'd been sent as a missionary.
to SA.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
And I'm sure they received you with open arms.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I knew that my higher power could beat up their higher power, right? I had all these, you know, at any rate.
Yeah.
So we started the Samson Society, and much to my delight and somewhat to my surprise, you showed up.
I did.
So give us some backstory to you. How did you wind up at Samson? Because Samson was not about sex addiction.
Right, right.
It was about addiction and isolation.
Right.
And you bit.
I did.
Yeah.
And that was really good because I had no one that I trusted.
Yeah.
With my secrecy.
Yeah.
And my issues at the time were primarily alcohol.
Yeah.
And I was drinking. I was drinking a lot, and I remember telling you when I first maybe had coffee with you, one of the first times I had coffee with you, that I said, Nate, I'm sure I'm not an alcoholic, but I drink like one. Because there was nowhere in my persona,
yeah,
there was no room for me to be an alcoholic.
Right.
I'm a professional Christian,
yeah,
for God's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, literally.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so how can I be an alcoholic? How can I be out of control? But there are these things that are happening to me as we know, you know, progressive addiction is a progressive thing, and
yeah,
my goalposts kept moving. You know, well, I at least I'm not doing this, mm-hmm, and then I would do this,
yeah,
and then, well, at least it wasn't like that, and then it would be like that.
Yeah.
And my family, my daughter and my wife were keenly aware of my problem, but they were like all alcoholic family members, don't talk, don't trust, don't feel.
Yeah.
You know, and so they didn't talk about me, and
right,
they didn't trust me. And they kind of just shut down emotionally because they didn't have the luxury of being disappointed again, because I had quit 583 times too.
Right, sure.
You know,
sure.
And for some reason, every time I quit drinking, I had felt the need to, you know, blow trumpets and send out publicity announcements or
yeah,
something
yeah,
to my wife and daughter so they could, you know, be assured of my sincerity or something.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And, but to get back to the Samson group and the Samson guys, I think God struck me mute for the first year that I was there.
Yeah.
I was totally like the voyeur of the group. I mean,
you were there, you didn't say much.
Yeah, I was like, I think people were beginning to think I was getting off on vicariously on the, on the sex addiction stories or something.
Yeah.
Because I just wouldn't talk about my thing, or, you know, it might be that I cussed in traffic or something.
Yeah, yeah,
that
yeah,
I,
yeah,
you know, needed prayer or something like that. But the thing that I realized in Samson was that it was a precursor to my 12-step recovery,
mm-hmm,
process and my going
yeah,
into addiction therapy and getting help and, you know, all the things that I did after that. And you were a huge part of that. And that's one thing I'd love for our audience to know is that you actually took me to my first few AA meetings.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
we met at the coffee shop across from the old historic Methodist church where the basement was the, you know, the dungeon of failure where they
yeah, where, AA meetings typically they're in the bowels of the building, right?
They totally are.
Yeah.
And I remember going down those steps and thinking, Jesus, it's come to this. You know, God, it was there such a, you know, like this seeking feeling of just
yeah,
like, oh my God, I've gotta go under the bridge and
yeah,
you know.
And then didn't you find such a peaceful place?
Oh, the most honest people I have ever encountered in my life.
You know, at that point, I was hanging out at AA meetings,
mm-hmm,
wishing I were an alcoholic, trying to be an alcoholic.
Working up to it.
Yeah, exactly.
I could give you some pointers. But
but the point is, I have breaks around alcohol, probably not as good as they once were.
Mm-hmm.
And I may still, my dream may come true. I can actually qualify. But I would just go and listen to drunks talk sense to each other.
Yeah.
And their inner experience matched mine so perfectly,
yeah,
even though our medications were different.
Exactly.
That I brought what I learned there into Samson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was amazing, and it totally changed my spirit. It broadened and changed, and I think brought color to my
yeah,
spiritual experience.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that 12-step recovery for me completely dismantled what had become a very rote faith system.
Mm-hmm.
One that I could do in my sleep, one that I, you know, wake me up at 2 in the morning and I'll give you the right answer, because that's what it was. It was an answer-driven paradigm. Good Christians equaled good theology.
Right.
End of story.
Right.
You know,
in my
experience. And I was watching God work in people through AA and the 12-step groups that had no category for evangelical Christian experience, but they surrendered to God in a way that I only wished I had the courage to do.
Yes.
You know, and that it challenged me. I remember my first sponsor telling me, Christians are the hardest damn people in the world to get sober.
Right.
And he's a Christian guy.
Yeah.
Which I love this man to this day, because he was so honest. He said, if you start playing that churchy bullshit with me, we're going to smell it a mile away.
Yeah.
And he said, if you want to stop drinking, I can't help you. If you want to live in a new way of being, thinking, and believing, and that's called sobriety, then I can help you. But if all you're trying to get out of this is to not drink, I can't do it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't even have the courage to tell him. I wasn't even sure I wanted to not drink. I just wanted to maybe drink like other people. If they had a plan B AA, you know, like,
exactly.
If there was like, you know, you buy into the big package, you pay this much, you buy the smaller package, where you just drink like other people, it's only this much, I would have probably bought that one, because I didn't know. I just always had the idea that somehow that, and at that point, I didn't understand what was going on in my brain or my body or my shame or anything else. I just knew that something was terribly wrong and that what used to feel good no longer worked.
Yes.
You know, it was interesting because the other night, my church, I go to an Episcopal church now, and we had a story night, and I got invited to be one of the storytellers, which was really a fun night. We had just some great stories. But I told the story, I don't know if I've even told you this, but I told the story of when I was 9 years old, I faked my appendicitis to get out of going to church. Did I tell you that one?
Yeah. But listeners haven't heard it.
But the listeners don't know it. So the short version is that,
give us the medium version. I've already conveyed this to Allie, and she wants more details that I didn't have.
Yeah, this is just me, a 9-year-old Baptist kid, third grade, waking up on a Sunday morning. And I tell this story at this storyteller thing. Yeah. And I wake up on this Sunday morning, and I'm just not up for Jesus today at all. And, you know, the five verses of Just As I Am, the story of the guy who got gored by a bull on the way home with declined the invitation to go forward.
Yeah.
It's told between verses while the organ plays, all that. I was ready to get saved again just so we could go home and have lunch.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
That was the kind of environment that kind of shaped my, some of my ideas at that point. And it was a lot. And so the morning that I woke up and decided I didn't want to do church, my plan was I'm going to do Bullwinkle and Captain Crunch.
Yeah.
I'll watch TV. I'll have nothing terminal that requires months of treatment.
Yeah.
But just something moderate that I can shake off about noon, and by 2 o'clock I'll have a miracle the likes of which Benny Hinn will be jealous.
Right, exactly.
And I'll be on my bike out to the creek. And that was pretty much how I was going to go.
Yeah.
And my mom came in that morning to get me up, and I basically just said, I don't feel well. I don't feel like I can go to church. I feel terrible. How do you feel, bad? I'm nauseated. I just feel like I'm going to throw up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I ache. I just feel terrible. How do you ache? Where do you hurt? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. My stomach, my side kind of hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Which side hurts? Okay, 50-50, you know, left, right. Let's go with right, you know. I said, yeah, my right side kind of hurts. You know, well, where do you hurt on your right side, upper or lower? And I'm like, let's go lower, because probably more things are serious the lower they are.
That's right, exactly.
Right, you know. So I said, yeah, I think down here. And I just kind of pressed around on my side, showed her where it hurt. She said, okay, I'll be back. And she leaves the room, and she comes back in a few minutes, and she said, you know, get up and put on some clean pajamas.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to the ER. And I don't know why you have to put on clean pajamas to go to the ER. I've still never figured that out. But apparently you can't go to the ER and look like you just rolled out of bed.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So especially in 1969 at St. Mary's Hospital in Evansville, Indiana. So,
there you go.
So I put on clean pajamas and we whisk me off to the ER at the pediatrician's request. And I go in for the litany of examinations.
Yeah.
You know? And my thought is, well, you know, how long can this take? I'm staying the course. You know, I can still be home by noon and still, you know, I can still be on my bike by 2 o'clock. And so next thing I know, I'm getting blood drawn. I'm being moved from all angles, ups and downs. You know, the examination for inflammation of my internal organs.
Yeah.
I would have sung all 5 verses of Just As I Am, buck naked on a gurney in the lobby to avoid that again. So, you know, I'm going through this whole litany of examinations and tests, and the doctor comes back in and he said, well, we're going to take you upstairs, and you're going to have your appendix removed today. And I'm like, what the? And he's like, yeah, we'll have you changed here, and we'll take you upstairs, get you a room, and a little later we'll come and get you, and we'll do a little surgery, and you'll be fine. And I am thinking, holy shit.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever version of that at 9.
Holy poop, thought. Right.
Yeah,
yes.
the Baptist kid thought. And I'm like, okay, so I have to stay the course.
Right.
You know, I have to.
You
got to
stay consistent
commit
now.
It because,
yeah.
Because, and here's an interesting peek into my psyche, too. I would have rather gone in and had surgery that I did not need
right.
than to be caught in a lie.
Right.
You know?
Yeah,
because
right.
Even at 9, my persona was already doing push-ups and getting ready for duty.
Right, right.
So I would have rather gone in and had surgery and risked whatever that was than to be caught in a lie.
Yeah.
And so, I'm scared to death. And you can't pray before you go into surgery if you have faked an illness to avoid going to church.
Right, exactly.
It's written down somewhere. You know, God doesn't hear the prayers of liars who try to skip church by getting sick with things they don't have. So I'm going in to pray for an illness that I don't have to be rescued. And, you know, visions of Ben Casey, the old, you know, show played in my head where people died on the operating table. And, you know, so I tell my parents goodbye like it's the last time I'm going to see them. And they whisk me off. And, you know, I wake up later and I've got this patch, this, you know, bandage and incision. And it feels like somebody's stabbing me with an ice pick. And the gas had made me sick.
Yeah.
Yet my stomach, so I was nauseated. I'm throwing up and it feels like somebody's stabbing me. And I'm whole time I'm thinking, well, this is my punishment. This is what God does to people that don't want to go to church.
Yeah.
Fake being sick. And, you know, my third grade teacher came and visited me while I was in the hospital. I was in the hospital 4 days. And, and that was, you know, back in, you know, the time where they would actually keep you in the hospital instead of making you walk off of the operating table and catch an Uber home. You know? Do you have a ride, by the way? You know, yeah, I think I'm good. But, you know, they kept me 4 days and my third grade teacher came and brought me the class pinata that was the art project for not the year, but the little season that we had in there. And, you know, everybody had made the crumply tissue paper, brightly colored, you know. And here's this four-legged pinata. I don't know if it was a horse or a dog or what it was supposed to be, but the class made it and they brought it to me because I was, you know, going through this terrible adversity, and I deserved the pinata. And the pinata sat in the corner of the hospital room and taunted me, you know.
Yeah.
It just called me an asshole, basically,
and
just said, look, you're a liar, you're, you know, you're not a Christian example, you're not this, you're not this.
Yes.
And all your friends have, you know, bought into this and sent this to you, and you don't deserve it.
Yeah.
You know, and you're getting all this sympathy, and you don't deserve that.
Yeah.
You know, I go home, and I had to miss several days of school, and one thing led to another. But I began to change at that point. I began to, I couldn't accept a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't accept affirmation.
Yeah.
I couldn't receive any kind of good stroke in my world because I didn't deserve it.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't let myself enjoy anything because I didn't deserve it. So if I found myself enjoying something, I quickly intercepted that because of, whoa, you don't, no. You've got this terrible secret of this thing you've done that caused your family a great inconvenience, a lot of expense. It went terribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And you, young man, don't deserve any of this public stroking you get for your music or all these other things you do. And that was when I got addicted to shame.
Yes.
Because I only felt good when I felt, well, I only felt right when I felt wrong, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I created opportunities from there and throughout my life to feel bad.
Yeah.
Because I needed shame.
Yeah.
I was addicted to shame.
Yeah.
When I was 13 and took my first drink, I didn't feel shame anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel anxious. I didn't have anything to hide. God loved me more when I drank.
Yeah.
You know, it was nice. And I remember pressing pause on that feeling, very much like what you described a minute ago, Nate, where I just said, this is going to be a part of my life.
Yeah.
I've been lied to.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
You know, this is not, you know, I didn't act unbecomingly. I didn't get sick. I didn't do any of the things I'd heard about.
Yeah.
This is not a bad thing here.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel shame. I didn't feel anxious. I didn't feel all these foreboding feelings about myself. I just knew how to feel better suddenly.
And so
you know, fast forwarding, you know, I didn't drink a lot through high school. I didn't drink a lot through college.
Yeah.
But I did start drinking socially when we got married, and when Trisha and I got married, and then when she got sick and was diagnosed with MS and ended up being a very primary progressive form of MS, I drank a lot.
Yeah.
And I drank more because I became a caregiver and I became a single parent and I became the room mother.
Was it at that point, do you think, that that shame and anger kind of flowed together?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because then I realized that God, I thought, had hung up on me.
Yeah.
Because what I had done in my attempt to compensate for my shame was I had created a persona like you talked about.
Right.
I've created the guy that worked really hard for Jesus. I made a career out of it.
Yeah,
had two songwriting deals and traveled with artists as a musician and then ended up at this big church as a music director. And I was working really hard for Jesus, and I resented the hell out of him hanging up on me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I told a friend very seriously that I wish I could have been an atheist at that point in my life because it would have been easier to me to not believe in God than to believe in a God that didn't give a shit.
Yeah, right.
Because I said, you know, these people, you know, if they're atheists, at least they've got, you know, nothing to expect, really.
Yeah.
You know, I can't not believe in God.
Yeah.
But I just don't know that he gives a shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was a really dark place, spiritually bankrupt place, because I thought we had had a bargain.
Yeah.
And he was not at all holding up his end when, you know, my wife was spending, you know, time in and out of hospitals and treatment centers and everywhere that we did and experienced in her whole saga. And so I drank. I just drank and I performed. That's the only two things I knew to do.
Yeah.
And fast forwarding to Samson, I started hearing people talking about the courage to surrender and the courage to let go and the courage to tell someone what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, to tell one person what we're doing. And you know, I remember the first Samson meeting where one of our buddies just cannonballed into the big deep into the pool.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh God, you have got to be crazy telling this stuff to people.
Yeah.
You know, this is the kind of stuff you pay people to keep out of the press.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
I mean, you are out of your mind. But it took me a year of going and building trust before I could sit down and go, there is something really wrong in my life. And it's not just, you know, I got drunk one night and I feel really bad about it.
Yeah.
This is some really dark habitual stuff that is happening to me and it's starting to scare me.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to do about it. because I'm realizing that there's not a whole lot to me, really. Yeah. You know. So when I did finally meet with you, and you asked me if I'd been to an AA meeting, I remember saying to you, why would I do that? I don't need to go to AA. Yeah. I just need to stop doing this.
Yes.
It's all about the behavior,
right?
You know, because it's just always the behavior. And when I got sober, I had the biggest spiritual crisis in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't know. I started from scratch. I didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
Didn't know who God was.
Yeah.
I didn't know what all of this other stuff had meant in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Because it had been about the behavior. All my life had been about the behavior, performing, and the shame. And I didn't know what to do with that. What do you do with shame? You know? And then they talked about shame keeping us sick, and we're only as sick as our secrets. And then we began to talk about the power of revealing our secrets. And then, you know, all of this stuff began to unfold, and it began to bring a whole new world into play for me that I had never experienced in all of my years. And now, you know, even fast forwarding to 13 years, thank God, of sobriety, you know, I'm looking back on it kind of 10,000 feet up,
yeah,
and seeing that this is an integration process. It's not a I'm giving up this belief system and I'm adopting this one.
Right.
At least for me, it was an integrating of things that that needed to come together to make sense. But not everything made the trip.
Yeah.
You know, not everything found a place on the shelf again.
Yeah.
We had to get rid of some things. We cleaned out some storage units and had a sale. But it was an integrating of truth.
Yeah.
As it began to come together and it became a way of being and thinking and living. And, you know, I haven't lived, like you said, it's not that alcohol is my only problem, but
right.
It was the one that was going to get me on the news.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
That was
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how the brain and, the body, work together to, perpetuate that addictive behavior.
Yeah, I was really struck by your terminology when you said that, you know, that's when your addiction to shame began. I was talking yesterday with Jay Stringer, author of that great new book, Unwanted, a therapist and theologian and researcher, an interesting cat from Seattle.
Yeah.
And he made the point that that very often our addictive behavior, the self-destructive behavior we use to validate and reaffirm a view of ourselves
mm-hmm.
as a flawed and broken person.
Mm-hmm.
In much the same way as perhaps somebody who struggles with obesity, look in the mirror, experience a wave of self-hatred, self-loathing, and shame,
mm-hmm.
and then medicate it by eating, because that's what a person like that does.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting, too, because, and Nate, you know, now I'm in the, recovery business, so to speak, and in my practice, and one of the things in our training that we learn is that those moments where you're getting that message,
mm-hmm.
These voices, they don't even have to be conversations anymore because they're so well rehearsed. They're impulse thoughts, and these impulse thoughts can take a nanosecond to have. They're not even a statement. You just know. You know the conversation. When you look, you see that, you feel this.
Yes.
You know, and it doesn't take any time.
Mm-hmm.
It's just at that point, it's a neural pathway.
Right, yeah, yeah. And rebuilding or building new neural pathways is, that's constructive work.
Mm-hmm.
It's progressive work. It doesn't happen overnight.
Mm-hmm.
It's intentional.
Yeah, extremely intentional.
And it requires, and I don't think it's something that any of us can pull off on our own.
Right.
It has to be done in a relationship and connection and community with other people. Okay. On my own, eventually I run out of steam. I get tired. I get afraid. I get overwhelmed. And if I am left solely to my own resources, and I'm not talking to anybody but me.
Yeah. Yeah, if you are your only point of reference.
Man, I'm going south. And I've got a relapse history to prove it.
Sure.
Yeah. Rex, I suppose that at some point during this conversation we were supposed to take a break, but we never took one.
We're good.
All right.
It makes sense that you've got to just go into it. We don't need a bumper to say, here I am. You know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We've got a few minutes left before we hit kind of the hour mark on this thing. And as my daddy, the preacher, used to say, the brain can absorb no more than the seed can endure. let's talk a little bit about that turn away from this focus on, I've just got to control this behavior, a focus on abstinence, and nothing else has to change. To this reorientation toward a new way of life and toward a positive sobriety.
Yeah.
You know, I remember, you know, my first sponsor in SA starting asking me questions that to me were totally irrelevant. They had absolutely nothing to do with what I was there for.
Yes, why aren't we talking about sex?
Yeah, yeah. So he wanted to know how much sleep I was getting when I was going to bed. He wanted to know the last time I'd been to the dentist and the doctor. He wanted to know, you know, what was my workout routine? What was I doing for physical exercise? And then, you know, when I couldn't answer any of those questions in a sensible or satisfactory way, he had pretty strong suggestions. He wasn't ordering me around, but he was really making suggestions for how to begin to do some self-care that would that could support the kind of life I wanted and would make my move towards sobriety, you know, a whole lot easier.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a client very recently that came in, and he said, I've been seeing you for a few weeks, and I want to know when we're going to talk about my drinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the question I ask isn't why the behavior, it's why the pain.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, first of all, why the pain?
Yeah.
And then we go down into a road where there, we find out what our triggers and drivers are. But turning that corner in sobriety where we suddenly are experiencing life in a new way where I don't, you know, I mean, it's like just one of the benefits is how much more time you have in a day.
Oh, man, it's amazing.
I mean, yeah, you know, and how much more money actually I have at the end of the week.
Yeah.
Because I was always spending cash, you know, to hide. I couldn't bear to have my debit card trail.
Absolutely.
You know, showing how much. It,
I went pure cash, believe me.
Yeah, strictly cash basis.
I didn't give any hookers my credit card.
Back before Venmo and all that stuff, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, there is the practical stuff. You know, I've got more time. I've got more money. What do I do with this energy?
Yeah.
Where do I spend this time and energy? Where do I invest myself?
Yeah.
But the one of the... both frightening and exhilarating things for me was as I began to have the courage to share my story here and there, people who would seek me out and, you know, come to me like Nicodemus in the dark of night.
That's right, exactly.
But they would seek me out and say, okay, here's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, can I have coffee with you? And then here's the thing.
Yeah.
And they would start telling me their stories. And not because I'm going to be able to cure anything, but just to have the priest role in their lives of hearing their, of being an empathetic witness to their pain.
And because of your vulnerability, because you had willingly become vulnerable, you were probably the safest person they knew.
Mm-hmm.
They had to talk to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And you... because of the courage of your own disclosure and living with some increased transparency, or you got to be the fortunate and privileged recipient of that story.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that impact? I mean, I know the answer to this question, but that how did that help your own sobriety?
Oh yeah, it totally because it shifts the direction away from me, mm-hmm. because I'm at this moment today as just as prone to get myopic and fall into the victim mentality as I was the day I quit drinking.
Yes.
I can talk myself through that process and spot it,
yeah.
but I can go there in a heartbeat.
Sure.
So when somebody's sitting there across from me and telling me, this is where I am, this is what I'm doing, and I don't think, you know, I know you and other people have changed your behavior or gotten sober or whatever. I don't think I can.
Yeah.
I just think this is too big. This is too much. And it's too scary.
Yeah.
I don't think I can do life without anesthesia.
Yeah.
You know, it's just too much. And then you're there and you can go, well, here's how this worked for me. Here's what I did. Here's what I didn't do. Here's what surrender looked like for me, mm-hmm. as opposed to something I used to think, you know. But it so much of it comes back to a broad understanding spiritually that you give people permission to have.
Yeah.
To experience. I tell people all the time, my new job is really not working in addiction. It's deprogramming evangelicals. and I'm not trying to dissuade them from, you know, their core beliefs.
Right.
But I'm trying to help them understand that more than one thing can be true and it can coexist.
Yeah, yeah.
And it might not look like what they thought.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think that the damage from that experience, I mean, I'm grateful that I was introduced to a life of spirituality, to God, to a higher power, to opening myself up to a spiritual world,
uh-huh.
through my upbringing and through my experience in church. I'm very grateful for that.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, I must recognize, and sometimes I get angry and cynical about it, a whole lot of other stuff was attached to that core information.
Yeah.
And I was told that that was essential, and then I was inoculated against any other thinking,
mm-hmm.
On pains of perdition,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that turned into a prison for me, which I didn't leave until really the only way to live was to leave.
Yeah.
But I still love the church I was raised in and the people I grew up around,
mm-hmm.
and I at this point. It can get difficult at times, but I can still worship.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I attend a very different church now than anything I ever grew up in or would have been, you know, considering at that point in my life. But the beauty of the experience now is that for me, I have seen God do the impossible in my own life.
Yeah.
And that sounds lofty and grandiose and probably overstating to some people, but I really have. And this opportunity now to share my story in a circle of people that that can embrace it, mm-hmm. It's a really beautiful way of being able to hold to the things that are important to me, spiritually, and the new things that I've discovered in my path.
You found a place where you can take your real self to church.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Instead of picking up what I call the, you know, quarter inch cardboard cutout of me and trying to keep it in front of me at all times.
Yeah.
You know.
And what I found is that if I will take my real self to church, even if it's a church that in its culture doesn't encourage that practice,
mm-hmm.
there are always people around who are attracted by real people.
Yeah.
And I become magnetic when I am who I am, when mm-hmm. I am who God made me to be.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we can create sub-communities within communities just by showing up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, David, time has flown. I think we may have taxed the capacities of our listeners. We should save something for another episode. Listen, listener, we'd love to hear from you. Love to hear how your story intersects in any way or contrasts with ours.
Mm-hmm.
Love to hear
absolutely
from you. And you can get in touch with us by the miracle of email. All you have to do is send us an email at positivesobrietypodcast@gmail.com. We will read with interest. We will hold in confidence anything that you don't want us to share. If your letter is something that we can share on the air and comment on, then we'd be happy to do that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, please do. Please do that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think this does it for our very special episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I thought we had great guests today.
And we do have great guests coming up.
We do. We have some really good guests coming up.
Yeah. So, folks, do us a favor. If you enjoy this podcast, tell people about it. Go ahead and give us a rating. Give us a like. Help drive the traffic so that we can spread this encouraging message to more people.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, until next week, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
We're your friends. We're your pals. We're your buddies. Your messed up buddies here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli. Music by Rex Schnelli. Theme music by Matt Ulrich. Hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett. Wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.